Hello, everybody. Are we getting excited for the ho-ho-ho holidays yet? I know I am. We saw that right around today is the 30th anniversary of the Christmastime classic Home Alone 2 Lost in New York. The film was released November 15th, I think wide release November 20th in 1992.
Now, we covered this back during the Christmas of 2019 as part of our fabulous sequel Christmas series that year, McAllister McLean Miss 2 Christmas Harder, that featured this jingle all the way to Die Hard 2 in our full review of A Christmas Story.
But since that was a Christmas release, to this date it's been exclusively for club member enjoyment only. But now for its 30th anniversary, we're letting everybody in on the fun of this movie.
I think Bald Move Christmases are pretty special, and this podcast will illustrate why. Typically, we review a few Christmas movies while drinking from our boozy advent calendar.
And I'm pretty sure we end up putting the whole McAllister family on trial in this one.
Well, they did lose a child over two consecutive Christmas holidays. That's a garbage family right there.
And you know, that's true. That's true. And I think this might be the first movie we've ever discussed where we didn't totally hate Rob Schneider and what he's doing in a film.
We're calling it the Yo Ho 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 Merry First Run Movie Christmas. And we'll be covering all new movies this year.
I think it's actually First Rum. I just want to correct that.
First Rum. Oh, let's read
First
run.
Rum Movie Christmas. And because of the First Rum aspect of it, we've upgraded, we've downgraded, or perhaps just sideloaded into a rum-themed advent calendar with 24 shots of premium rum for our enjoyment. We're going to be doing a minimum 3 of these shots per Christmastime event.
First up is David Harbour playing a Santa Claus looking for revenge in Violent Night, which will be out in theaters everywhere December 2nd.
Then Lindsay Lohan tries to make a holiday comeback in Excess rom-com Falling for Christmas, all new, out on Netflix.
HBO Max is releasing the long-awaited sequel to A Christmas Story called A Christmas Story Christmas, where grown-up Ralphie takes his family back to the old neighborhood to celebrate the season.
And of course, we'll end things with a secret holiday movie classic for you to open and discover over your Christmas break.
Each Friday, we'll have the highly anticipated boozy Christmas lunches with Jim and Aaron.
And on two Wednesday evenings, we'll have festive live streams with games, good cheer, and some Bald Move Community Secret Santa public gift exchanges.
And all US-based Club Bald Move fans will be mailed a physical Christmas card from me and Aaron. All international folks will be emailed a high-resolution digital copy suitable for printing and display.
If you're hearing this, it's not long until deadlines to receive a card and get in on the Secret Santa have passed. Got to check out christmas.baldmove.com for more details on deadlines and joining in on the festive fun.
And in the meantime, enjoy our scotch-fueled discussion of Home Alone 2 Lost in New York.
Today we're going to be talking about Home Alone 2 Lost in New York, the 1992 follow-up to Home Alone, also directed by Chris Columbus. All the original cast has come back, and they add Tim Curry and Rob Schneider to the mix. Boy, I have got a million things to say about this, Jim.
Yeah, me too.
Before we get started, I just want to have a production note here. So we record the live watches, and we rent it off Amazon Video, which means we have 48 hours to get our notes done and come back, or we'll get billed twice, and we can't have that.
Of course, $4 is precious.
Yes, I mean, what are we? Not going to be cheap bastards? I did not know this, but you can only watch one title at a time. And you and I share the Amazon account, right? So we went home last night to do our second watch, and you were watching, and I was locked out.
Oh, fuck.
And here's the thing. Our schedule is so fucking tight that I almost broke out down into tears because I'm like, I don't know fucking when I'm going to do this.
You should like texted me.
Well, here's the thing. A Christmas miracle happened, Jim, because I remember on my network-attached storage device, I have a whole folder called Christmas that's full of Christmas joy, and I had a copy of Home Alone 2 right there, ready to go. Christmas was saved.
Great.
I'm calling it a Christmas miracle. It filled my heart with joy and love. What did you think of this movie?
I'm going to say that this movie is both better and worse than the first movie.
One of the things I want to talk about first is this a really good, is this a good sequel? And
I feel like we need to discuss it because I'm still not totally sold on whether it's better.
This movie's not trash. This movie is not a cheap cash grab.
It does a lot of the same things that the first one does.
Right.
But I feel like that's kind of the point.
Right.
And I don't know. Maybe we should just talk about it and then circle back to this question at the end.
Like we'll have one of those. What's this? Buzz's fake trial at the end.
Okay.
Ladies of the jury.
And I'll
we'd like to present the evidence against and for Home Alone 2.
Fucking bullshit speech.
Well, we'll get there.
I'll call you a trout sniffer and it'll all go to hell.
I have a couple opening salvos I want to discuss. Some things I just really like that we're going for the movie favor. There's two things that we're going for the movie's favor and two things that might take people back. I'm going to treat them as trigger warnings. There is out of nowhere the Twin Towers. And then there's also out of nowhere Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Mugging on screen for 5 seconds. So just be prepared emotionally for both of those things to hit you in fairly rapid succession.
I was confused by the Donald Trump thing at first, but apparently he owned the Plaza Hotel at that time.
Did he?
So it makes a little bit of sense that he might show up in the halls.
It's a condition.
Probably. I'll let you film here if I can be in the movie.
Uh-huh.
And he turns around and mugs to the camera. It's,
Yeah. He almost grabbed the camera by the pussy. In fact, that was the fifth take, the one he was able to restrain himself.
Yeah.
Two things I really liked about this film. Right away, I loved the logo, the stylized house, and then it gets surrounded by the big city, and it really kind of like is a very. I mean, it's a master of graphic design, because it just gets you ready for the premise of Kevin, suburb of Chicago, Kevin coming to the big city, and also I think. This movie made me want to go and experience Christmas in New York sometime.
Rockefeller Plaza is kind of amazing during Christmas. Yeah,
and everything it's like I think it would be fun. Maybe not like I don't want to spend actual Christmas in New York because that's like I feel like Christmas is for like your house and you know, your own tree. I'm kind of with Kevin on that. But
not
like
for Florida,
a week or two, a week or two before Christmas, that'd be a lot of fun. Go see some shows, go experience the lights. Like I said, ice skate at Rockefeller Plaza. I never really felt that way before, but watching this movie several times made me nostalgic for a New York Christmas I've never had.
I want to say so during the live watch, I was thinking, or before the live watch, actually, I was thinking this movie might be a little more plausible than the last one. Because I remember a whole bunch of, obstacles that they threw in the way of Kevin's mom getting back to the house, and they knew where he was, so it should be pretty easy to just, call up the local cops and say, hey, go check on him, that kind of thing. After thinking about it, it's actually less plausible. I think the first movie holds together a little bit better because there are no flights,
and you have a ocean separating you.
Right. There's a massive distance.
Like all you have to do is explain the fact that he didn't get on the flight and the door closed and there are wheels up. And then once that happens, minimum few days to get back to the country.
Yeah. So he's going to have that time alone anyway. Mm-hmm. There's nothing they can do unless they call the cops, which the cops were just like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah, right.
Not interested.
There's no one here.
It was negligence on the cops' part. This one hangs together, not quite as well. Because they make a point of it, right? Like, they're talking about in the very beginning how, oh, we're fucking lucky to get flights this early or this late in the season, which I got a whole fucking tirade on the negligence of the people around Kevin in this movie.
Yeah.
But they didn't plan very well, A. But B, if that's the case, if you can't get flights, then how the fuck did they get to New York from Florida with a whole fucking 15 people?
Yeah.
They got their whole damn family on a single plane. On Christmas Eve.
That's the other thing is like once they find out, are we sure they flew back or did they drive? Because I thought there was this.
From Florida in less than a day? That's a long ass drive.
That's a great point. Maybe it's after Christmas. No, it's like Christmas.
It's Christmas
Day.
Eve. Yeah,
they fly in Christmas Eve.
His mom gets there and meets him in Rockefeller Plaza.
I don't know.
Yeah, they use it as a plot point to like, oh, we're lucky to get seats together or get on the same plane.
Well, I want to talk about the plot because almost everything that they introduce in the first 10 minutes is like things that they weave into the plot.
Oh, it's so good.
Like, for example, Kevin's playing with his talk boy. which is a period accurate toy, you know, a video, a audio recorder. Like, kids love that shit still today. Cameras, video recorders, if they you give them a tape recorder or an MP3 recorder, they're going to like pretend they're disc jockeys, and it's a lot of fun. So, and everything it records here is important. Like, he's recording random shit, like what's on TV that's talking about the Plaza Hotel. He records his uncle in the shower.
And, they demonstrate how it works, right? Like, with the two yeses that he delivers to his mom. Like, they do some really tight stuff here. The inflatable clown comes back, right? Like, everything they're doing is setting up
Kevin
something later in the
about
movie.
Not having a Christmas tree, because how can you have Christmas in a place without Christmas trees? Because he loves, and the mom, oh, you'll love your Christmas tree. The father...
Even the Plaza Hotel.
Yeah.
The game show.
Yeah. There's like, as they're sleeping, there's a newspaper that like blows over warning that the Wet Bandits has escaped, which are like, you know, that's a pretty elegant way to kind of bring them back into the plot. You know, the dad, oh my God, he fucking unplugs their... So there's like this multi-adapter, plug adapter that he unplugs to plug in his fucking camcorder battery or something. Mm-hmm. And he plugs it back in and doesn't check anything. And he's just fucked his alarm clock up.
Which doesn't actually come into play. So this is like kind of wasted, right?
It does. Because that's why they don't make they don't get up for their alarm.
Yeah, and I guess it's what sends them running through the terminal.
And it's like same thing. And like they do the like I thought it was kind of cute where when the parents wake up and realize what's happened, they do the Macaulay Culkin scream into the camera.
Right.
It's like, okay, yeah. I mean, it's a little hokey, but what do you want? It's Home Alone 2. Where does Kevin get the screaming in his DNA?
There you go.
It's right there. Do you want to talk about Marv and Harry a little, just in general?
Okay, yeah, I don't have much about them in this movie, but
I just kept on in my notes that like Marv is the dumbest son of a bitch alive, like even way dumber than even in the first movie, and he was pretty dumb. But then I realized it kind of makes sense for both these guys to walk away from the events of the first movie, that massive head trauma and like resulting like concussion-based syndrome or just, you know, personality disorders, lower IQ. It actually kind of tracks. And maybe Harry just loves him so much he can't ditch him, even though he's just a massive liability.
Yeah. I wonder why Harry isn't affected in the same way.
Well, I think he's a little bit the same stupid because...
But I think his plot is actually really good. I think the plan that they have to go knock off this toy store on Christmas Eve kind of works in 1992. Like, banks aren't going to be open on Christmas Eve, right? If you're taking a bunch of cash because credit cards aren't, like, everywhere like they are now.
Yeah.
Where do you put that money? I mean, you would probably have a guard.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if you had a bunch of money in your tills or your safe or whatever it is. I mean, that's the other thing is, like, I think in 1992 they had fucking safes.
Yeah.
And they're just, like, literally just grabbing handfuls of and they're all $1 bills. People.
There was a padlock on that box.
Yeah, it had a, like, a button, you know, like, a lock and a button you had to push. But so it's interesting because Harry's talking about his toy store heist, but, like, Marv has the idea of, like, knocking off the candy store. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it's interesting that Harry's like, no, you idiots. Who robs a fucking candy store? And then his idea is a toy store, which is the most adjacent to candy store that you can get without actually still being a candy store.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, shit. I mean, yeah, I don't think we even have toy stores anymore. Toys R Us went out of business. But a big part of Toys R Us, surprise, surprise, candy.
Yeah, that's true.
One would argue that there was a candy store inside Toys R Us. Mm-hmm. I thought Harry was being a little high and mighty dismissing Marv's candy store idea.
I think send one of them to get the candy store.
There you
send
go.
Send the other to get the toy store.
You double your chances of success.
Yeah, and have your chances of getting caught.
Boom, there you go. There's a lot of things in the plot that they do to make the parents maybe relax their guard. For example... things went wrong in the first movie when the neighbor kid was fucking around with a hat that looked like Kevin and they were doing their head counts and he didn't even make it to the van.
Yeah.
This time, Kevin, someone gets him up from upstairs. He gets on the van. They explain why they're not sitting together because, as you said, it's like incredibly tough to get tickets. But who in the right mind gives a 10-year-old their own ticket to hold through an airport?
So here's the thing. Yeah, that's maybe, fair.
Like if they had plenty of time and they're teaching Kevin responsibility, then sure. And if he loses it, you can always go to the gate and get one printed out and blah, blah, blah. But like, they're literally sprinting through the airport and they give this 10-year-old a fucking ticket. Do they give the bedwetter a ticket too?
Probably.
Does the 7-year-old that can't hold his fucking bladder get a ticket?
I think so.
It's madness. It's madness.
And I mean, I don't want to get too far into negligence because we'll go there. But like, when they get to the gate, nobody stops and turns around and says, okay, I'm the first here. Let's just tell the gate checker that,
right,
look, I got all these people coming. Mm-hmm. Hold the door.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody turns around. Everybody just sprints right up the loading platform.
I can't believe a mother who just left her child at Christmas last year sprints through this crowded airport and in no time looks back and checks to see if Kevin's with them.
Yeah.
Also, why did they give Kevin the fucking money? He's holding his plane ticket.
Well, okay, so I have an explanation for that.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I do. He has his dad's bag because right before... Like, right as they're getting out of the car where the baggage pickup is, he's looking for batteries. And his dad's like, I don't have time for this shit. Here, just take this bag, look for the batteries. They're in there. So he hands him the bag, right, assuming he'll get it back in just a second, right?
Yeah, but that's the thing is Kevin stops in the middle of the airport to change his batteries on his talk boy, which I guess separated. That makes sense. But again, what the fuck, parents?
Well,
what the
kid, Kevin, what are you doing? You got to change your batteries right now.
But that's what the dad's supposed to say.
Right.
He's not supposed to be, here's a fucking bag with $5,000 of cash and all our credit cards and all our traveler's checks. You fucking handle it yourself. What does he think Kevin's going to do? Wait till he gets on the plane? I don't know.
I mean, it's established his dad's an idiot.
Yeah. I thought it was actually clever, his dad's stunt double. You know, like there just happens to be a guy.
Same
that
code,
looks,
I could buy it.
Yeah, I mean, that's happened. Like, I can't tell you, probably a half dozen times I went to like grab my dad's hand in a crowd or at a store or like tapped him on the shoulder and it was like some other dude. You know, it's because when you're like significantly shorter than your parents, like they all kind of look the same from the tits down within, you know, like if you got to wear the same color pants and the same shirt and the same kind of broad build, you're just gonna, so I get it,
rough haircut,
but there's this also, I thought it was pretty elegant, him pile driving the gate agent, so like all the tickets go in the air, and like again for 1992 that felt like a entirely plausible thing. It's like, okay let's go on the plane, do you see your dad? Kevin's like, yeah, he's right there.
Yeah,
all right, well, his family's on here, so let's close up and ready to go now
and make sure he finds them before you let him go. And he just, they get in there, he points to a guy whose back is toward them,
right,
and the flight attendant's just like, okay,
is it,
I guess,
believable
that
there's an open seat on this plane at Christmas too?
No, it's definitely not. She says just go find a seat.
Yeah,
I thought they made a big deal about how packed these planes are. They do that several times in the movie, and then they just undermine it.
Yeah,
later.
And there's a bunch of other stuff. Like Kevin sits down to the guy next to him, and like there's many times that he could be find out that he's not going to Florida. Like he asks this guy, "Hey, have you ever been to Florida before?" Guy starts speaking French, and he's apparently French and on the autism spectrum because he gets no social cues that stop talking or that Kevin doesn't understand French. So that forces
Kevin... Even though
Kevin,
he started that conversation in English, right?
Yes. And that forces Kevin to put his headphones on to ignore the French person. And just as he puts his headphones on, they're like, oh, greetings from flight from Chicago going to New York City. And so he doesn't even know he's on the plane from New York City.
Yeah.
Now, his parents are in the flight. They're in fucking first class. I still can't believe these people, fresh after losing their kid last Christmas, they should be like obsessively checking for all their kids. They don't think to get up and look to see if the kid is there.
Even though she knows something is wrong. Something's not right here. I just have a feeling.
Yeah, and your fucking dumbass husband, who is responsible for fucking up this situation twice in a row, tells you, like he did last movie, aw, it's not going to happen. Lightning can't strike twice. Oh, you're being over... Man, don't let this idiot ever tell you you're overreacting about something, lady. Like, that should be your alarm bells going off. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move.
What's amazing to me is this is the second year in a row that this has happened.
Yes.
Like, this is just Kevin's Christmas now.
Yeah.
Every year, it's now his tradition to get fucking lost or left. It's amazing to me that 2 years in a row this would happen.
No, Also,
wouldn't he be a fucking superhero by the end of this? Like, can you imagine the kid whose house was burglarized in Chicago, mm-hmm. he single-handedly fought off the burglars and got mm-hmm. them captured, is now doing it in another... Like, he is a superhero traveling the country stopping bad guys.
He would be an international sensation. He would be interviewed on talk shows. They would have a movie about him. Comic book series. You are absolutely, absolutely right. I will say that it's almost worth it for them not to find out until the airport, because I thought the luggage scene... where, like, they hand Kevin's luggage all the way down, it gets to the bedwetter, it goes all the way back up, and then
Kevin's out here.
Pretty good.
Mom screams and faints.
Yeah. And also gets, like, a stage 5 concussion because that melon hitting that concrete floor, not going to be good.
We'll talk about concussions.
That's
the least egregious.
So Kevin uses his Talkboy to reserve a hotel room, and he does that thing where if you've ever had a Walkman or a Talkboy, you know if you push on that door to like kind of bind up the wheels, you can do a poor man's voice pitching down.
Actually, that was part of the Talkboy's features. I remember this. Talkboy was an actual thing.
I thought he was pushing on the door, because you could absolutely do that with tape players too.
You certainly could, but this one had a built-in function. It had a switch that would do half speed, and I think it also had a double speed function.
Which wouldn't be useful in this circumstance.
Obviously, yeah. Yeah. But that was like a super popular... Actually, in 1993, the year after this movie came out, it was so fucking popular that Hasbro had to pull their advertising for it because they ran out of stock. They were just like, well, fuck, we can't meet demand here. Pull all the advertising.
Holy shit, they wouldn't do that nowadays. They'd double the advertising to make kids want even worse.
Yeah, and sell them in 1994 again.
Yeah, exactly. They'd have a special edition that's twice as expensive and half as twice as cheap.
Right.
And then they'd make it, yeah. That's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. But I wanted one so bad.
I thought you had one.
No, I never got one.
Bummer.
I had 75 Nintendo games, but I couldn't get a fucking Talkboy. Thanks, Dad.
You should have wheeled and dealed, like taking half of those Nintendo games and been who's got a Talkboy? I got Mega Man.
I wasn't allowed to have friends at school.
Oh, right. Right. I forgot about the sad circumstances of our childhood.
Yeah.
This launches this rivalry with Tim Curry's concierge character. Which let's talk about this for a minute, because there's three main antagonists here at the hotel. You got Tim Curry as the concierge, you got this lady playing Hester Stone, who's just like this old kind of like severe strict hotel clerk woman, you got Rob Schneider playing like the bellhop,
Cedric.
Cedric?
I don't know.
I know we made a lot of jokes about Rob Schneider. He's not bad here, right?
He's got a director, I'll begrudgingly admit,
and a script, and they're making him do just the right amount of stuff. He doesn't really unnecessarily overact.
Adam Sandler's not involved.
Adam Sandler wasn't involved. He wasn't at this point so up his ass that he thought everything he did was funny. I actually was really surprised at the restrained comedic talents of this Rob Schneider.
And I think it's entirely because Tim Curry is the star here, right? Like, of these three antagonists, Tim Curry is the guy that they are writing for.
Yeah.
And Rob Schneider is sort of incidental. It's like, oh, he's the bellhop. Give him some funny line. Give him some funny plot thing, but don't focus too much on him. Let's get Tim Curry. And Tim Curry fucking shines.
He does.
He's incredible.
Also, like, Tim Curry's a bit of a scene chewer, and he's like, you know,
that's why I love him.
He's playing this over the top, and it's like, what, are you going to be an asshole and try to upstage Tim Curry?
Right.
Like, that's a war of escalation. You're not going to win.
You're not going to win that. God, there are so many good scenes with him. That scene where they all bust into the room thinking they caught Kevin, and then he pulls out the Tommy gun stuff.
My favorite is where...
so good in that.
So... there's a whole... okay. The what drives this plot is Hester Stone says, okay, you can have this reservation, et cetera, but your father has to sign some things when he gets in, because of course he does.
Right.
So Kevin's on a clock. Like, there's a certain amount of, like, leeway that these hotel people will give him, but right away, Tim Curry, he realizes something's up. This is just this kid coming in here, doesn't add up. He tries to do some... sneaking in and try to, you know, get some intelligence about Kevin. Why is Curry using some weird accent when he's pretending to be housekeeping? He's got this, like, outrageous German housekeeping as he knocks and lets himself in.
I don't know.
But Kevin's doing the reprise of, like, the, you know, the dummy dancing party scene.
Right.
And he's using the talk boy of his uncle singing in the shower and the Bozo the Clown doll. And he essentially makes it seem like his father catches Tim Curry spying on his ass,
mm-hmm.
which you would think would put him really back on his heels. And the next day, Kevin comes down and is like, and he says, oh, was your father upset?
Well, it does.
Huh?
It definitely does. It's only when he runs the credit card and realizes it's stolen that he gets back on Kevin's trail.
But
right?
That's the thing. He does that immediately after the scene, like he's still trying to uncover. Because here's the other thing. Why
I just
the fuck
took it.
Is the concierge also doing accounts receivable in his spare time? Like, why is he the guy that's running the credit card?
I think, like you said, he was still a little suspicious. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you know, you just like, I'm just thinking, like, Tim Curry has a guest threatened to beat him up because he looked at his ass.
Mm-hmm.
He would be, I feel like Kevin should have gotten a little days more of a slack.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Whatever, the movie needed him not to. But that scene where the credit card comes back is stolen and they superimpose Tim Curry's face over the Grinch
smile.
Sublime.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. So he gets Curry to get him out of the hotel, to give him time to uncover his malfeasance, gets him a fully chauffeured trip to his toy store, Mr. Duncan's. Duncan's toy store, you pointed out in the live watch, pretty smartly staged. I was going to give you a moment to shine. Because
smartly staged.
Well, like,
I don't remember this at all. I was drunk.
Okay. Well, remember, like, in the, like, big, you know, they show, what was that? The
big piano.
The big piano. Like,
F.A.O. Schwartz, the store?
Yeah. It's like, this is a bad example because I haven't seen that in a long time. But, like, I recall that being a lot of contemporary toys that probably Whereas this Duncan's toy store is almost like a timeless toy store.
Yes. The film doesn't age as poorly as it could.
Right.
Because, like, 1992, I think, was like Barney. Barney was fucking everywhere
probably.
In 1992.
Is that Furby? That's post Cabbage Patch, pre Furby.
It's probably pre Furby. Yeah. I think it was Barney was everywhere. And it's nowhere to be found in the store. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I want to talk about with Mr. Duncan when we get to the negligence section. But
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it keeps the movie very, very lost in time where you're never going to look at that and say, look at those old toys. That's stupid.
They're so old that it's like charming. Like, you're supposed to understand that these are, even though, like, if you unironically got a child a toy from this store, they would hate it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like, at best case, you're going to be like, oh, thanks. Because what the fuck is a kid today going to do with a scaled wooden horse?
But then he's got weird things like, the entire store is decked out in Christmas stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There's not a single modern fad toy to be found.
Mm-mm.
Except there's a bucket of pencils that are just like neon squares and triangles and loops and shit right up by the desk, even next to the candy canes,
uh-huh.
which aren't they kind of the same fucking thing, except you can eat the candy cane? I don't know.
You can't write with the candy cane. You can't eat with the pencil.
And then he's got this fucking monster soap, which I thought was candy.
Yeah.
But it turns out later it's soap.
Where is the end cap of that in all these classic toys?
I there must be a back room for like the kids who don't give a shit about Christmas.
Oh, right. It's like the XXX section.
Yeah, it's for the atheist kid section.
The mischievous kid section.
Right.
So it looks great because it's got that kind of like Christmas nostalgia. And he's a pretty smart guy, and he explains he loves kids. He loves kids so much he donates all of his proceeds on Christmas Eve to a children's hospital, which moves Kevin to donate $20, which is weird because the movie plays this like a moment of generosity, but we know that Kevin has thousands of dollars and it's all essentially stolen money.
Oh no, but he says, I'm not supposed to spend this money, which I know is bullshit because he's spending money like crazy. But he's not supposed to spend this money, but he does have $20 at home that he saved up from shoveling sidewalks.
See, I thought that was just a bullshit cover to explain why he's got money.
Oh, I thought it was legit.
Huh.
I assume it's legit.
So I don't.
So he's donating 20 of his own hard-earned driveway shoveling
while
dollars.
He's on a $1,000 candy bender.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I still think the point, even if I take it as generously as you, but I think that Kevin's just like wanting to give this guy a pittance. Because, okay, why doesn't he give him 50 from his dad's stash?
Because he doesn't have 50 at home. He's got 20.
But he's... Okay. All right.
If you're going to be as generous, I can't approach it from any other angle.
Yeah.
I think this is Kevin's money he's giving him.
So the guy is so moved by the $20 donation, he gives him two turtle doves, which are probably retail value of $5 each. Christmas ornaments are fucking expensive.
If that. I mean, they're shitty. The ceramic what are they made out of? Yeah, like shitty ceramic, rough like, ceramic, not even polished.
Like, I feel like that Christmas ornaments come in like 99-cent Walmart shit tier or like... $12.99 auteur handcrafted shit.
Right.
And it's like there's not much in between.
Man, I went shopping for tree toppers not too long ago. Fuck me, those are expensive.
Yeah.
You want a nice one?
We went, so I mean, here's a tip. Go to like one of those giant, like where the whole town is built around Christmas. There's like one in northern Ohio, there's one in southern Indiana, and they have like a 5-acre Christmas store.
Santa Claus, Indiana.
You get a good topper in Santa Claus, Indiana. Guaranteed goddamn tea.
Cool.
And they have all tastes and all budgets accommodated. You know what's really funny about the giant Christmas store in northern Ohio? They have like 5 football fields worth of Christmas stuff, and there's one sad end cap for Hanukkah.
Oh.
Like out of the entire fucking store.
Why bother?
There's one
if you're gonna
one
give it
end
that treatment.
Cap for, and I'm like, why is it even there? It's
like this guy selling this fucking monster soap, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Why do you even have it?
Exactly. The menorahs are the monster soap. You've got it. That's exactly the parallel I was trying to draw there. The introduction of the sticky bandits into the plot where they come up and say, "Hiya, pal," and Kevin does his famous scream and it like zooms out and echoes, but it's also in New York City, so no one gives
Nobody
a
cares.
Shit.
Yeah.
No one even like turns to look.
And they kind of expect him to, I guess, because they're, I guess in Chicago, people would notice.
Yeah, be like, hey, what the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
So Kevin has to act quick. He uses some more of his dad's money to buy these $5 fake pearls, bust a string out, and
trips just like every citizen in a 3-block radius.
Yes. That should have taken out like 30 people as busy as those sidewalks were.
Oh, and it will. I mean, those things are still on the sidewalk.
Yeah, they're not going anywhere.
Nope.
But
moms pushing strollers, you got business guys hustling off to Wall Street, like
maybe Marv flailing around with a sticky bandit glove.
I do love that it catches a whole bunch of those on it.
Maybe that's he just rolled around trying to get up and is frequently concussed state and he picked up all of the pearls. So at this point Kevin runs back to the hotel because that's his refuge, but Tim Curry's ready. And there's this madcap full lobby press of Kevin, and they're all giant pratfalls. Kevin gets packed up to go, and he buys himself some time with the Angels of Filthier Souls. I mean, this is just... So this is one thing. It's like, this scene feels forced. Like, people... They felt like, hey, we got to check off all these boxes. We got to have him scream. We got to have him do some kind of shadow play with some inanimate object. We got to have the Angels of the Filthier Souls. And what felt forced to me is like all of Kevin's pranks were aimed at different people. It was like the wet bandits. It was like the pizza guy. this, it's like all of his tricks are forced onto this one particular person, and it makes it all feel a little dumb.
Like he's a little dumb, like Tim Curry's character.
Yeah, like Tim Curry's character is simple, which they're also playing him as like a smart, sophisticated guy too. Mm. And that's what I'm saying. It just feels a little forced. I'm not saying it's not funny. Like it's funny to see
when they call out Cliff
and the way they mug it. Dude, like, just the comedic performance is very, very funny. It's just the situation it's forced. Like I shudder to think if you didn't have Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Handling that.
If it was Rob Schneider at the helm.
Yeah, if he was having to do the response to Kevin, it wouldn't work at all. But he goes out of there, runs right into the arms of Sticky Bandit. Marv explains the whole plot. Because which of course he's recording. He does. Yep. Which he's recording on the fucking Talk Boy. And then there's this nice payback of like Marv being inappropriately fresh with a woman on the sidewalk.
Yes, and this is actually really good.
And as they're hauling Kevin off, he like thinks fast. He sees, it turns out, the same woman.
Yeah, coincidence. I'll let it slide.
And he pinches her on the ass. She turns around, sees it's Marv, and Marv is so fucking stupid. He thought her slap was like a come hither. He's like, fucking hashtag me too, you jackass. But she gives him this like devastating right cross, drops him. Harry turns around, gets the same fucking treatment.
And Kevin's like, Kevin's seeing the twofer here, right? He's like, okay, you knocked out Marv, but I can get Harry with this too. It was him.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. He pins on it.
Yeah.
So they get waylaid. Kevin flees into the park, the Central Park, and the Sticky Bandits reason to themselves, oh, Central Park. This is a fucking hellhole, apparently. Mm-hmm. Didn't know this about 90s Central Park. Maybe it's accurate. Grown men get flayed alive, so he's just as good as dead. And it's not for nothing, because their scene of Kevin in New York City at night is like crazy. You've got hookers, you've got this random crazy people, you've got a zombie cab driver. Mm-hmm. He sees this pigeon homeless lady, which I forgot to talk about.
He'd seen before during the day.
So I don't think Kevin's bougie fucking family, I don't think they've ever seen a homeless person. Because
they've never gone downtown Chicago.
Yeah, and she's not even everywhere. Particularly like she's not a particularly scary homeless person. I could see like a young child being kind of charmed. She's feeding the pigeons. Mm-hmm. She's got like a neutral expression. She's got a little bit of a resting bitch face, but like they talk about her being covered in pigeon shit, but she's not really.
She's a little shit.
And it's broad daylight, and she's just minding her own business, and Kevin gives her the full fucking McAllister scream.
Yeah.
And runs off.
Apologizes hilariously for screaming in her face.
Right.
It's funny.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is because at night he finds her again. He gets his foot stuck in some fucking rock, and it causes him to do the McCulkin scream for like 2 minutes of screen time, which is a bit much. She frees him from this crack. He runs off and decides, oh, wait, I guess I don't have to be a reactionary asshole. She's trying to help me out, so I'm going to treat her like a human being. I don't know how the hell she gets into this, like how she lives in the New York Symphonic Orchestra.
It's a really good question. I would think the birds that she brought in would probably get out, and you'd have like a weird, like a dirty work
everywhere.
Kind of scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'd be shitting into the tubas.
Yeah.
It's a bad scene.
Like if they explained that she used to be like a head usher there, and like the guy who runs the place kind of takes pity on her, and as long as she keeps the pigeons outside, but like they don't explain anything because it's a kid's Christmas movie, whatever.
Yeah, and then Kevin drops some Christmas science on this lady.
Here's another thing I don't think really works.
Okay.
Because the first movie, there was a really sweet natural playoff between Buzz building up this scary neighbor-looking guy who obsessively shovels his driveway and salts it with like the fact he's a serial killer and he keeps his body. Like, I can see that scaring Kevin. Mm-hmm. And the guy was kind of scary, but it turns out he was friendly and nice, and Kevin was able to give him some pretty sage advice about dealing with his problems in life. Because the thing is this guy is a rich asshole. He lives right next door to Kevin McAllister's dad, who we've already established is a rich asshole.
Yeah.
So like it's fine for this kid to prattle on to this guy and give him some life advice. Mm-hmm. All this shit he's saying to this fucking homeless woman is cringy as fuck, man. It's so fucking self-serving and gross.
Self-serving, huh? Okay.
I mean, okay, it's not self-serving. It's just he's running his mouth about something he doesn't even know about.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah. Kevin has never had a non-parental, non-sibling, non-familial relationship in his life, right?
Sure,
as far as we can tell, except with the Sticky Bandits, the wet bandits.
Yeah.
that one's not very healthy. Yeah, I don't know how he understands, you know, about opening your heart and like not wearing clothes covered in shit.
And that's going to fix her problems when her problem is that she used to have a home and a job, and now she doesn't. She's homeless and she's covered in pigeon shit. So she can talk. She can talk all she wants. On also, that's terrible advice for New York City. Like, hey, pigeon lady, just start talking to people more often because that's all you need to do. And I don't know. I just like when he says, well, maybe you should wear an outfit that doesn't have pigeon poop on it. And like she should have been like, all right, well, yeah, great. I just need to get clean clothes. I need to find some place to have a shower.
And there's no sign by the end of the movie that she's taken his advice.
Well, how would she? She's a still, homeless person covered in pigeon poop in New York City.
And she's still covering herself in pigeon poop, feeding the birds at the lake.
But
the,
she's got the, a fucking turtle dove. This kid remembered her over a 24-hour period.
Home Alone 3.
It's just like there was an arc to the old man in the first one, and it worked, and it was sweet, and this just doesn't. They try to fucking force this shit in again, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work. In fact, Kevin is kind of a little bit nastier in this film. So when they have this heartwarming turn where they play the Kevin theme slowed down with like a child's chorus orchestra behind it, and he looks up and he sees the sick kid in like this perfect like urchin robe coughing in the window, and he
like it's 1886,
right, like this is fucking we just woke up in a Charles Dickens
crossover.
This kid's mutated and
the nurse comes out and says survival of the fittest, kid, get fucked.
Eight
kids waiting who are less sick than you.
If God wanted you alive, he wouldn't struck you with whatever's wrong with you. Get out.
Jesus.
No, but we're in a Charles Darwin novel, and plus the way he's filmed is like Macaulay Culkin, annoyingly beautiful child, and he's like surrounded in this like warm incandescent Christmas lights. I swear to God, he's glowing like the Sylvanian Man. And he says, you know, I swear, I can't let kids be robbed on Christmas. So he launches into Operation Ho Ho Ho.
I like this. I like that he's taken it to the bad guys this time.
Yeah.
Because he's not on the defensive. He's on the offensive.
Yes.
And he is a good
provoking
way to take
the fight. He has staged it on ground that's favorable to him.
Yep.
And he is prepared, and he's going to dish out.
And he's fighting for something good here. Like, you can't fuck with kids on Christmas.
Yeah, it's not just survival. Like it. Yes, broadly speaking, I think this is pretty good framing.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about the torments that he inflicts on these guys?
Yeah.
First up, he throws a brick through the toy store window to set things off. He set a simple teeter-totter. Mm-hmm. That's dumb as hell.
Oh, completely dumb. You're not going to go this high off of the teeter-totter.
No.
And also, Harry could just step forward. Instead, he stands on the thing, turns to Marv and goes, Marv, don't run over here and jump on this thing that I'm standing on.
Right.
Just take one step forward and you're off of it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So then next, they are trying to, they, despite all evidence of contrary, think this kid's idiot, and they try to get him to throw the taped confessional down, and probably the camera too.
Yeah. So they say, throw the camera down. These fuckers have no idea how a Polaroid works.
Yeah.
You throw that camera to him, he's still got the photos.
Yeah,
you dumbasses.
So Kevin could have done that, but then they'd gotten, you know, they would have gone and it seems like a alternate way to go is just call the police and have them meet him at this facility. But then
he does eventually, right? He's like, his whole plan is to lure them into the park, but he waits.
Right.
And this is where Kevin turns sadistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like Kevin
is saying.
Tormenting these creeps.
He is punishing them. He's punishing them. And this scene with the bricks is one of the funniest things, but it's also just horrific.
It is. I don't think it's the most devastating thing that happens to them, but it is right. It's maybe the second most.
I mean,
and it gets me every time.
Focused on one individual, and they're like, right. Marv takes three bricks to the head, and they're all the sound they make, and the marks, the makeup marks that they make on his face are stupendous. Like this man's brain case is just destroyed.
And they kind of play it, right? He's got the blurry vision. Like,
oh, yeah. He's even more fucked up now. So Marv now goes up to the doorknob with the infinite string.
Mm-hmm.
This is the stupidest fucking thing. Are they trying to explain this, that Marv is just actively concussed and he doesn't know what he's doing? Because he winds up with the trifecta, the rarely seen triple penetration, staple ass, face, and dick. How does he do it? How does he do it?
The only better thing would be if somehow he could have stapled them all together. Right? Could he have stapled his ass to his face?
Yeah.
And his ass to his dick?
I mean, I don't know if the but geometry it's, works it's amazing. Out, but he could probably try. Then he finally gets the door open, and he falls down. Isn't he on the ground floor?
Yes, there's a basement, though.
But I thought it felt like he fell down three fucking floors.
Yeah, it's a long drop.
And he says, I'm up top when he said, I don't know, it's weird. Maybe he's talking about versus the basement.
Yeah.
And the sound effect he makes when he's like twisting, it sounds like his neck is just like three pieces of broken celery.
Yep.
Okay, next gag for Harry. The zippers with the duffel bag full of the duffel bag with the zipper full of wrenches and hammers.
Yeah, after falling off the ladder and cracking his back on the that happens a lot.
Oh,
people
right.
People hit the concrete a lot in this movie.
Right, because Kevin's coated everything with that slick goo soap.
Yeah, and the pearls and the ice and right. like everything. People are cracking their backs all the time.
Lots of trauma to people.
But these wrenches.
But plus, I think that's one of the more plausible traps too. That like,
so.
You know, the door opens, the thing unzips, and you get a bunch of metal dropped on your head.
Mm-hmm.
Marv then is downstairs, and Kevin's coated the entire basement floor with, like, this slick goo soap, and he's doing this elaborate, like, 30-second-long pratfall that ends up an entire shelf of paint dumped on him. So he looks like the worst. And then...
This had to be a ground-up renovation, right? Like, the foundation is fucked, because... Yeah. The way he slides into that shelf, mm-hmm. it's at like 40 miles an hour. This must be a 45-degree floor.
This is the leaning brownstone of Brooklyn, apparently. Right. No, Manhattan.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I don't know if we're going to get in this in another section, but like we've established that Kevin's family is loaded. Kevin's uncle owns a 4-story brownstone all up.
Yeah, millions of dollars.
Across the street from Central Park in Manhattan.
The McAllisters are, they must own a chain of hotels, right?
I mean, his dad is so stupid. What could he possibly do for this much money?
I mean, maybe it's not his dad makes the money. Maybe it's his brother. So maybe they're both freeloaders. Maybe his uncle. So he's got at least two uncles, right? He's got the uncle that's on the trip with him.
He's got the cheapskate uncle, which right. I guess is from the mom's side.
So his cheapskate uncle is freeloading off of his dad.
Yep.
And I think it's implied by how stupid his dad is that his dad is freeloading off the other uncle
right.
who owns the brownstone, who we don't know much about.
Which, by the way, is just being renovated. Like, he's probably over in his Paris. Oh,
he's
wait,
got a second.
That was the plot of the first movie. His uncle owns, like, a big flat in Paris, too, right? That's where they're going to Christmas the other year?
That might be true. Yeah.
Anyway, this family is just like... And the thing is when I was a kid watching this, I never appreciated the class differences between me and Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why that didn't strike me as like, wow, they own this giant fucking building in New York City. And mm-hmm. like, look at their house. Their
house
is like,
Chicago, yeah.
can easily house 14 people with no problems whatsoever. Right. No one has to share beds or anything. Well, except for Kevin. He's the one
with
guy
the that bedwetter,
has to
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the torments. Marv gets this entire shelf of paint and shit dumped on him. He goes to the mud sink that's right next to it, which Kevin is hooked up to a welding unit, and Marv gets fucking electrocuted.
Yeah.
I think this might be funnier than the bricks, because Daniel
Stern
screaming, and the way they flash to the skeleton that's got the beard and like it's...
And then he's shaking afterward.
It's just really, really funny physical comedy.
It is.
It's like full on Looney Tunes shit when they show the skeleton, and I laugh my head off every single time I see it.
Yeah, this movie is sillier in some ways with its tortures.
Yeah,
like,
there wasn't...
Because when, you know, Al Pacino, when Joe Pesci gets his head caught on fire mm-hmm. and he blows up, the hat kind of splays out like a,
right.
some kind of Wile E. Coyote, Elmer Fudd,
yeah,
kind of thing.
In that scene you're referring to, Marv walks into a room that triggers a flamethrower that sets his head on fire.
His hat on fire, which he doesn't just take off.
He sees it burning in the mirror, and they do this pretty impressive stunt where stuntman does like a headstand on a toilet that Kevin has filled with some kind of flammable fluid.
Yeah.
And then lowers himself in, and as the stuntman's doing it, the fire is still going up, so this fire is engulfing his head as he does this. Uh-huh. He hits the thing, explodes. Like, this is a fatality. Like, Marv is electrocuted, Harry's dead. Uh-huh. Are there any theories out there that the wet bandits are ghosts at this point? They're vengeful ghosts.
See them, but probably.
Yeah, because like I think these guys are dead at this point. okay, this one, I keep changing my mind which one's more horrific. Them going up the stairs, in this case, with the reprise of the paint can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marvin Harry, they got wise to it. They do the pantomiming and stomping up the stairs, and then they take turns faking getting hit. And then they think, okay, there's two paint cans, but Kevin has got probably a 100-pound cast iron, 4-foot segment of like 6-inch pipe.
This is the worst. This is the worst punishment in the entire thing.
These guys take it full to the teeth.
They do, and then they fall a full story into the concrete basement, and then the post drops onto them.
He cuts the rope holding the post, which bounces down the staircase and hits him either in the junk or the face again. I'm not sure which would be worse.
It's insane. It would kill you. That first blow would just destroy
you. The impact and the sound and they utterly sell how, but it's Looney Tunes, so you know, whatever. You're right, there wasn't anything from like the first movie where like he steps on a 6-inch nail that just goes right through his foot.
Uh-huh.
Like that's some fucking Saw shit. This stuff
it's not played for quite the same Looney Tunes effect.
Yeah, it's more of, this is more Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
So then, okay, the lamest one, I think, is the tool chest coming down the stairs.
Yes.
Because it's another one of those things where it's just felt forced.
And it's not plausible. Like, everything else I feel like kind of could happen.
Sure.
This one, there's no way that chest goes down the stairs upright.
Yeah.
There's no way it busts through the door with the force it does. Uh-huh. There's no way they bend their noses in Looney Tunes fashion. Like,
although that makeup effect was pretty good.
Yeah.
Like them having to flatten noses and straighten them out, that almost worth it. But nah, this is, I think, the worst of the torments.
I agree.
And then they have the kerosene rope where, you know, they're climbing, you know, Kevin has a top, he climbed down. Now the guys are trying to follow him and he sets this thing lit on fire. They fall from like 3 stories into the basement walkway. Somehow this triggers like 100 cans of varnish to cover them.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the whole thing didn't go up like a bonfire, which I think would actually be, if he burnt these men alive in some pit on the sidewalk, that's actually a crime.
No, like there are plenty of crimes committed, but yeah.
At this point, Kevin had gotten away. You can't claim any kind of castle doctrine defense. You just burnt 2 men alive that you had no cause to.
It's true. It's true.
So then, like, there's this. This is all kind of denouement stuff at this point. I forgot. Kevin gets caught because he gets arrogant and he forgets the fact that there is a, you know, ice, and he slips and breaks his back, which really amuses the sticky bandits.
Yeah.
They drag him to the park to kill him. But fortunately, he's made friends with the pigeon lady, and she covers Marv and Harry with pigeon food,
which they've also set up earlier in this movie, which I thought was nice. Like, he asks, you know, how you attract the pigeons, and she has him throw the seed up in the air and kind of get where they're going.
And then they get so, you know, Twitter-pated with the pigeons just covering them, and they do. Like, plus, I'm Joe Pesci is just punching pigeons here.
Mm-hmm.
Pigeons are taking punches left and right.
But we've seen a pigeon take a newspaper. Like, that's the thing. I feel like, I don't know if they're setting this up.
New York City pigeons.
But those New York City pigeons are brutal.
Yeah.
Like, they don't give a fuck. You can hit them with a newspaper. You can kick them.
Was it Joe Pesci was trying to get him to scram off of a rail, and he has to, like, beat them several times with a newspaper to get him move over.
Right. So he can fit his elbows on the rail.
Yeah, these pigeons are like, hey, we're roosting here, pal. Come on. Hey, yo. You know, they're not taking any of his shit.
No, they're not. And so they set that up pretty well, where I believe that these pigeons would be a problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't just stand up and get out of this.
So like there's rest of the movies, essentially him, getting back with his family, which I kind of want to talk about in the whole, our prosecution against his family and negligence. I have a whole section on like Kevin himself. What is your overall opinion on Macaulay Culkin in this movie?
I think he's good, not great.
I feel like I think he's just as good in the first movie. It's just everything is being forced. Mm-hmm. So like him wiggling his eyebrows and the screams and like the other thing is this movie's just over 2 hours. And I feel like this should have been even more than the last Home Alone, like a 95-minute movie.
So this is exactly, I was shocked to see on Amazon to the second it's 2 hours, which is 17 minutes longer than the original. And I don't feel like it was really better for it. I think I'm with you.
All right, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, they take at maybe dial back the smarm on Kevin and his whole relationship with the homeless lady, or change that all together to something else. Mm-hmm. Maybe get rid of one or two of the torments. Trying to think what else
you get could rid of cut. Donald Trump.
Yeah, get rid of that.
That's a valuable seconds you get back.
But it's like they're forcing him to do a whole bunch of, like, let's say everyone loves Macaulay Culkin, so let's make him do everything super extra. Mm-hmm. And he's a little bit older, and it just didn't work as well as the first one. Plus, it's also like it's hard to catch lightning twice in a bottle, especially when you're intentionally trying to do everything the first movie did, only more of it.
Yeah.
Where he talked about his, you know, the way he treats the homeless pigeon lady when he first sees her. Does Kevin know the significance and or value of tipping?
He clearly does. He clearly, because when he flashes that cash, so he sets this up, and this is why I think Kevin is so sadistic. It's not just, you know, there's a good case to be made against the wet bandits here that he doesn't have to burn them with the kerosene rope, like you said.
Sure,
and
sure.
He's simply doing that for his own joy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the tipping thing, when he gives the gum... So I think he gives the gum to Cedric because he saw him snooping in his bag. He's like, well, I'm going to fuck with this guy.
Okay.
And then, but later on, he flashes the cash. Once he trains Cedric not to take a tip, he then flashes the cash and says, okay, I guess you don't want any of this. He knows what he's doing. He knows what tipping is.
Especially since at this point, I thought Cedric was playing it pretty cool. Like, oh, this kid is kind of adorable. I'm still taking care of him. I'm doing his thing. I know, and I'm joking with him. Like, oh, I got a little bit of your tip left over. He wasn't being a dick about it. And Kevin was a dick about it.
And how much time did Cedric spend setting up this fucking candy bar in the room? Because, you know, moments before he checked in, that was all booze.
It had to have been.
Now it's all candy.
These guys, like I said, Cedric is like, he checked in his bag, which, okay, that's nosy. In fact, I don't know why they gave, maybe because you're right, otherwise it's just Kevin being cruel to this guy.
Right.
Like, they're taking idolatrous care of this child for until they find out that he's got a stolen credit card and is taking him off for a scam. Mm-hmm. Like, what the fuck? I felt sorry for Rob Schneider, and I don't ever want to feel that in my life. They also, like, they force him losing his swimming trunks in a pool, which I guess is cute because he's clearly wearing, like, these giant adult-sized pool that he bought in, pool trunks that he, what, bought in the hotel gift store?
Probably,
because I think they're all marked up with the Plaza shit.
The big adult robes and
it's cute, but, like, him losing his swim trunks, like, did we need that? I don't feel that's a little, cut that out. Let's get the runtime another 10 seconds shorter.
Is that? I feel like if you're going to go for that, have the lady reading poolside get splashed with your cannonball water.
Yeah.
They just didn't go for it as much as they could have.
Right.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
The Angels with the Even Filthier Souls, again, the setup I thought was pretty funny. Because it's Kevin being this cute little boy, the ice cream guy is there, and he's like, would you like two scoops? He's like, I'll make it three. I'm not driving. And just the idea that this is like a PG version of a rated R movie. Uh-huh. Where the guy, yeah, you've been smooching. You've been smooching with everybody. You've been smooching with a flat Frankie. You've been smooching with Tommy the Fish. it's just really fucking hilarious. Uh-huh. It just didn't pay off as well as it could have. And then we're going to get to Kevin's family and what a bunch of assholes they all are. But they keep trying to force this schmaltzy, like, American tale, somewhere out there duet moment between Kevin and his mom where they look out at the moon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not having any of this because, lady, you let this happen again. Kevin is an afterthought. You guys do abuse him. You're terrible people. I don't believe Kevin loves you. I don't believe you love Kevin. Get this Fievel shit out of my face.
Well, they play it like she's the only one he does love. Like, even if you want to say, okay, we'll grant that he does actually love her, even though she's left him twice now, consecutive Christmases. He's not looking out for his sister. Mm-mm. Or his little brother or his dad. Mm-mm. He's just pining for his mom.
Yep.
Which I think is hilarious.
She's the only one, like, that literally tries to communicate with him in the entire series.
Yeah.
Like, every time he gets in trouble I'm going to argue that a lot of the trouble he gets into is not entirely his fault. Mm-hmm. She's the only one that goes up and tries to, like, make a half-hearted attempt to have a sitcom moment, and then the second he pushes back with accurate statements about the family's bullshit, she's like, oh, Kevin, you're a fucking asshole, and I guess you'll get your wish again. Anyway.
Yep.
Let's talk about the family.
I want to talk about negligence in general, and yes, we can start with the family.
This all starts with the choir fiasco.
Yeah, okay, I mean, Buzz.
I'm not going to defend punching your brother in a Christmas choir, but also every adult in that room was seeing what was happening,
yeah,
and they all made Kevin the butt of their joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they set up this, like, weird parental judgment chamber, and Buzz is giving this bullshit non-apology, starting with ladies and gentlemen, the jury. I just feel like Kevin's family is so stupid that they don't see right through this.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't see how that this is, like, perpetuating the abuse. In fact, the fucking jackass uncle is, like, minimizing what little value that Buzz's apology had by saying, well, it was pretty fucking hilarious. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel perhaps most sorry in that whole scenario for the pianist.
Oh, yeah.
Because she takes it wrong. Right to the head. She drops backwards off
stage. Oh, my God, yes.
And lands neck first on what I presume is a concrete auditorium floor.
She gets the full Sticky Bandit treatment. She didn't do nothing.
She does.
She's trying to play for a children's Christmas pageant, for Christ's sake.
Brutalized.
But I don't know. I'm on his side because he's got this whole rant about you guys are a bunch of losers. You fucking make fun of me. You never. And here's the thing. I feel like you can't judge Kevin's punch and his brother in isolation. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Buzz gets away with his shit all the fucking time.
He's the eldest brother.
And I feel like they could have fixed it by just making Buzz give a pretty good performance. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe have him cry some crocodile tears. And then as he's boo-hooing, he tilts his hands over to his brother and winks at him or something. Yeah. As it is, his parents are just fucking idiots. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm on Kevin's side. And then when the uncle tries to give him some shit and he's like, oh, I wouldn't want to spoil your fun, Mr. Cheapskate. I'm like, give it to him, Kevin. Give it to him. So we talked about all the shit that happens in the airport. The next thing I want to talk about is when they get to the airport and they're given a police report about what's going on. And they end up breaking down and laughing hysterically about how this has happened again. How is CPS just not immediately called?
Because they're upper middle class white people. If this were a poor black couple,
I think we can drop the middle. I think we're at upper class here.
The
that
uncle's
fucking
in
brownstone
upper class.
Ain't upper middle class.
No, the uncle's definitely an upper class. Okay. I don't know about this dad. He's got probably $1.5 million home, but that's upper middle.
Yeah. Plus, maybe if you're just getting $1 million salary for doing nothing at your brother's shady New York real estate business, that's just a front for some international fucking crimes, then maybe, yeah, I guess that is upper middle class.
Yeah.
But I just want you to remember the scene where the cop is patiently trying to explain to them situation, trying to help them with their obvious fucking terrible parenting. Mm-hmm. They have no credit cards and no money. They have to stay at this fucking shitty no-tell motel where it's raining all the time and they have to watch A Wonderful Life in Spanish. But I'm sitting there and realizing, okay, they're in Miami and their child is lost somewhere in the continental United States. Mm-hmm. It's a good bet he's not in Miami, but even if he is, maybe leave part of the family there, start driving up Florida. It takes you 6, 7, 8 hours to get from Miami to the fucking panhandle. Mm-hmm. Start get a hotel in fucking Tallahassee so you're ready to spring. You're ready to cover. You can go to New York, get Chicago. You're shaving off almost a half a day of your travel time, lady. No one gives a shit. No one gives a shit. They're just chilling in their fucking motel.
I mean, that's the statement of the entire movie. No one gives a shit.
She was bumming rides off of John Candy's polka van. Mm-hmm. Last year? What the fuck? There's no ocean separating you, lady.
She was paying 7 times the ticket price to scam some old couple out of their tickets.
Did they think Florida's an island and not a peninsula? did that cover that? An upper middle class rich school?
I mean, it practically is. It's so swampy. Yeah. No, I mean, the case against the McAllister parents is astounding. Just the idea that they would lose Kevin again, second year in a row.
At Christmas. Exact same circumstances.
The idea that they would be staying at a shitty hotel in the first place. They've done no vetting whatsoever this hotel. They've trusted their dumb fuck uncle to book his honeymoon hotel from 20 years ago, assuming it'll just be as good as it was back then.
To be fair, they have no money, no credit card, so maybe
but
also...
But they booked this ahead of time, right?
No. I don't think... Oh.
Yeah.
Is that the joke?
The joke is they went to this hotel on their honeymoon.
I thought the joke is they couldn't pay for their resort that they... So they had to go this because they had no money. They trusted the...
Well, they don't have any money, yeah. But I think they already booked the hotel. Because when the cop asked them, do you have a hotel and stuff to stay at? They're like, yeah.
Oh, wow. I thought this was the hotel of last resort.
No, this is first resort.
Oh,
this is the one they booked.
God.
The parents aren't freaking out about having no cash or anything. Mm-hmm. They never address the cheapskate uncle is fronting or she's got credit cards that she didn't put in his bag. Maybe. Maybe the most egregious and shocking thing of all, though, is the end of this movie. Mm-hmm. The case against the family is the end of this movie. They've just had this big heart-to-heart moment with the Christmas presents. Buzz tosses him a Christmas present and says, hey, we should let Kevin open the first one.
Yes.
And then he fucking doesn't. Then he says, oh, let's all just dig in.
He gets
while
all
Kevin's
the fucking credit.
Daydreaming.
He gets Johnny Williams schmaltz music.
Score, yep.
And just as Kevin's about to open his presents, he's like, oh, everybody go. And I'm like, right. You fucking did it again, Buzz.
And then Kevin walks right out the fucking
into New
door.
York City.
No one notices.
Yeah.
They've done it again. It's Home Alone 3, lost in New York again because he walked outside on Christmas morning.
Right. So he could find the pigeon lady and give her the turtle dove.
And nobody fucking notices.
Their father could just, I think, put her up. He could just write a check for $100,000 and not even miss it. And yeah, she gets two turtle doves.
He could just give her a floor of the brownstone.
She saved this boy's life. And she gets not two turtle doves. One turtle dove. So Kevin can keep the other one. They'll be friends forever.
I mean, that's how turtle doves work, right?
Apparently so.
Here's the other thing, though. The parents, I don't know. Why aren't they booking these trips sooner? They're complaining about this time of year. We're lucky to get on the same flight. Why didn't you book it 6 months ahead of time? You knew you were going on this fucking trip, right?
The needs of the plot required them to be this stupid. I mean,
But they don't. Because then they're complaining, oh, God, it's 3 days before Christmas. We're lucky to get on the same flight. And then they fly 15 people back to New York on New Year or on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
With no problem.
That's true.
How much do those fucking tickets cost? He complains about the $900 room service bill.
There's a cutscene
where... And he just paid $55,000 to fly his whole fucking extended family up to New York.
So in my Christmas folder copy of this movie, there's the deleted scenes. John Candy has started a polka air. And he just happened to have a 14-seater and like it's smoke rolling out, but he got him there. So it's like they shouldn't have cut that scene, but it was definitely there. But the thing is, I can't believe this movie. The next time they think of Kevin, he's out there cavorting in the streets of New York City. I swear to God, if they didn't get the room service bill, they never would have thought of him. They'd have gone back to Chicago and left his ass in Chicago.
Home Alone 3, lost in New York still.
Still lost in New York a year later.
My parents came. They found me. I'm still fucking lost.
Kevin's got as much. He's living with the pigeon lady. He's as much pigeon shit covered.
And Tim Curry. Let's bring him back.
Yeah, because Tim Curry lost his job, obviously, because he's a sex pervert that failed to stop a child from going into New York City from his hotel for a third time.
Holy shit.
It's Curry, the pigeon lady, and Kevin just around a fucking trash barrel on fire in Central Park.
I'm going to say, ironically, the least negligent person in this movie is Tim Curry.
Yeah.
He is immediately on to Kevin.
And Kevin is devious and smart.
Yeah. But Tim Curry is persistent, right? And he knows something is up. He's checking into it. Now, maybe he's a little creepy. Maybe he should be breaking into people's rooms and staring at their asses in the shower.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, who fucking hears someone's taking a shower and you, like, cartoon tiptoe in to look at them? Like, you're either Kevin McAllister. Or you're a creepy concierge.
Right. And then, oh, my God, the gall of his parents at the end to insinuate that he's done something wrong letting Kevin get away.
They have no moral authority.
It's incredible.
Everyone they've explained, like they laughed hysterically at the police because this happens so frequently and no one slaps them. No one gives them any judgment. And this woman, the gall of her, like you said, Tim Curry, the saint of the fucking movie, gets slapped and beat and berated and called idiots because these strangers couldn't do what his whole fucking family of 14 people could. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
They take it to Hester Stone. You know, she's negligent for letting him pay for the room. The hotel booking agent is an idiot. What human voice sounds like this talk boy in slow motion booking a room? And then I have to take it to Mr. Duncan. Poor Mr. Duncan. He's negligent as fuck. I mean, we look at his store.
Yeah.
He doesn't sell a single damn Christmas toy, but all he has is Christmas toys. Like, these old ass Christmas toys. What's he selling? He's selling monster soaps and pencils. Those are the only fucking... He has to give away the ornaments.
Because
he can't fucking sell them.
Yeah. It's like essentially a Christmas toy museum. Also, you can get goose soap and pencils.
Right.
So if you need some goose soap, kid, you need some pencils for Pencil Pop. He's essentially a toy store museum that sells fidget spinners. That's
basically
like the fidget spinner of its day.
Oh yeah.
I want to focus special ire on the uncle now.
Oh yeah.
Uncle Frank. First of all, his son's a bedwetter, and he says, "Easy on the fluids, pal. The rubber sheets are packed."
Yeah.
You're going on an all expenses paid trip to Florida, courtesy of your brother. Buy two sets of sheets, rubber sheets. You cheap asshole.
I mean, it's established.
What's
I going to
send him
back?
$5.
Yeah.
Uncle Frank says if Kevin sees him naked, he'll never grow up to be feeling like a real man. Mm-hmm. What kind of shit is that? What kind of weird, psychosexual fucking game is he playing with his nephews, man?
And then he's leaving the door open.
Then he leaves the door open and he's doing bad things. He's luring, he's grooming. It's gross. I'm not having any part of it. And then at the kids' Christmas part, a Christmas pageant, which maybe the whole family doesn't need to be drugged to see the two males of the McAllister family singing, but they did. And his uncle is over there. I can't tell whether the uncle is pretending to be asleep, like making a big show of how bored he is at this children's thing, or the actor portraying him is just extraordinarily bad at pretending to be asleep in his capacity as an actor, because that's like doesn't work on any level. I got the telescope. I'm trying to just look at both end tubes. It's like too big, too small. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Uncle Frank, you're a fucking asshole. You're probably, it's always the people screaming about the perversity that are the biggest perverts. That's actually not true. It's just something I'm throwing out there to be funny. But yeah, Uncle Frank, you're a fucking asshole.
Yeah. And he booked in that shitty hotel.
And he booked him in the I didn't even have that as a bullet point because I didn't realize. I was giving him the benefit of the doubt that, like, you know, they're broke. Uncle Frank's got some pocket change and he's doing the bet. Oh, I know. Me and Betty stayed here. But no, he doesn't even have that, Frank.
No.
You don't even have that. You don't even have that. Let's talk about whether this is, in fact, a good sequel, Jim.
Okay.
I think there's certain things. I think that, number one, Home Alone, the original, is hard to beat because it was completely original.
Yeah.
And it had, like, the world wasn't ready for a kid as cute as Macaulay Culkin and is able to kind of do the heavy lift. Like, 90% of the movie is just him. He's carrying that fucking movie.
That's the thing. That movie gets to the action pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they sequester his family away, the wet bandits come in, and boom, we're in the movie.
I do think that if you remove the necessity of... I feel like that this movie was as airtight as it could be with the situation it was in.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, it does rely on a lot of the coincidences, but like the second time I was watching this, there's almost like a magical reality to it. Like Kevin is making a Christmas wish and it's coming true because the universe is forcing it.
Again, like, yeah, the first time his wish came true,
right?
It just
all comes together like a ballet to enable it. And I didn't get that in the first movie because it just felt like it's more of like, you know, the parents had one mistake. They got up too late and they... didn't, you know, they saw a kid in the back seat and it wasn't their kid, and that, you know, it's like once you get in legitimate circumstances, cross the ocean, you're fucked. Okay. With the hand that this movie is dealt, it's about as good as it can go. I thought that setting it in New York was really good.
And making him actually lost in this movie. Like,
yes.
Nobody knows where he is.
Yeah,
so you can't just like call the police and have them go get him.
He's not in his neighborhood. He's not in his own house. He's not in a familiar situation. It felt like a natural leveling. This feels like a level two for Kevin McAllister.
Yeah.
But I think, again, the fact that this is two and they felt like they had to run back every gag... some of them just like I they should have, like, before they ran back a gag, decided, hey, was the reason that the movie was funny is because it had this gag in it, or is it the reason that this thing was funny is because it had all these really inventive gags that no one had ever seen before?
Yeah.
And I felt like for every, you know, thing that works, like Tim Curry getting caught in the shower, they should have like written out the Filthier Souls thing. They should have come up with something else. Something different.
See, I'm gonna kind of agree and disagree. I think the running back of the gags only really works here. It does work for me, but it only really works because Tim Curry is so good. And I think if you had a Rob Schneider or a lesser actor in that role, I would be bored by it. But Tim Curry sells this shit.
I just think that, like, imagine if when they're attacking the brownstone, if like Marv burnt his hand instead of Harry, and Harry stepped on a nail instead of Marv, and they did literally run the exact same gag back, people would be like, well, this is cheap, this is hack, this is boring. To their credit, all of the torment gags are kind of original, except for maybe Harry getting his head caught on fire, but then they go above and beyond with the toilet gag.
Right, and they do the staircase thing again, but they knowingly do it, right? They're playing off of the first one.
Yeah, and I understand that like some things are trademark, like Kevin screaming, stuff like that, but I just felt like some of the stuff, and again, it's not all, it's like I can't say that this one needs to go, this one needs to stay. It's more of like there's 10 times they do this in the movie and they need to do it 5.
Yeah, I feel
And then they need to take the 5 weakest ones and replace them with something completely original. And I think that Kevin trying to do something for the kids was a nice sentiment, but the relationship he has with the pigeon lady is not as wholesome, and cute as the thing he had with the grandpa that had the son that he was alienated with.
The pacing isn't perfect here, and I think they knew it. I think they knew they were getting to the Marv and Harry stuff a little too late in the movie, and they tried to inject some of that with like the chase with the pearls and stuff the first time, and it mostly works, but it still feels just a little off.
I think that Tim Curry is a massive improvement over like having a recurring antagonist that's not just the Sticky Bandits, instead of like the pizza guy, the lady at the corner store, the like having someone of that caliber in this situation, and you know, him playing this like snooty concierge is just like perfect. Mm-hmm. I think that worked a lot better. I mean, like I said, like if Home Alone is a perfect 10 for 10 Christmas movie, then this is like a 7. But I don't think it's... I'd say it's better.
I'd say it's like 8. I think this... It's interesting because I think this movie feels more like Christmas than the first one.
Interesting.
The first one... I'm trying to think back to the moments of that, you know, heartfelt Christmas kind of feel like you would get in the traditional Christmas movies. Home Alone 1 doesn't... I don't feel like has a lot of those moments. It has the big one at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Where he wished for... You know, he realized his wish was... a folly, and then he regretted it, and then his parents come home, his mom comes home and saves him, that kind of thing. But like throughout the movie, I feel like this is more of a Christmas movie.
I think the Christmas movie parts of it felt a little bit more forced, where like you had the, you know, him having the late night mass vigil with the grandpa, where he kind of like helped him solve his family problems, and they had the heartwarming Macaulay Culkin.
I forgot about that.
And I said
that
felt natural and organic, whereas the Pigeon Lady stuff felt forced. And, you know, the stuff between him and his mom loving each other and doing the Fievel American Tale shit in the first movie kind of worked because this felt like a fluke. But in the second movie, they double down on all that shit and makes it so it's like that.
They should have written it a little more knowingly, a little more like this again.
I
think they could have been better written.
And like I said, like, you know, I think you could write this. You'd have to be a little bit more cynical. Yeah. But you could write a movie where like Kevin's like, yeah, these families, they're kind of assholes, but I'm used to them. And we have some good times and some laughs. But they're trying to play it so fucking wholesome that they've got the setup for like a Married with Children Christmas. But you're trying to give you a Wonderful Life Christmas.
Right.
And the movie is just being pulled in those two directions, like darker, meaner, crasser, but also we got to get Johnny Williams to hit the high Christmas notes. Yeah. And, you know, we got to have Macaulay Culkin looking like a Christmas angel as he stares at the... It's like I said, it's not terrible, and it's still a great family movie. And if you kind of take this stuff all on like a magical realism or a Looney Tunes level and don't think too much about it, it's pretty good. It's just, I mean, the first Home Alone is a near perfect movie.
Yeah.
Like it came out of nowhere, and this is, again, not a cash grab, but certainly
not
something like Macaulay Culkin is like this close to puberty. Turn this thing around.
Right.
Turn this thing around. Get this fucking thing out the next Christmas. So
speaking of cynicism.
Yeah.
The internet can be cynical sometimes.
Uh-oh.
I don't know if you're aware of that, but I was looking around. I saw that the internet pointed out this Pigeon Lady looks just like Piers Morgan, which I think is cruel. I think that's a little mean.
If anything,
she looks like Cole Meany in a funny hat.
Transporter Chief Cole Meany?
Yes.
I think this woman, Brenda Fricker, I looked up her IMDb, and it turns out that she was the horny mom from So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Okay.
And I'm like, yes, of course that's where I saw her from. I think she's really good in a fairly thankless role.
Mm-hmm.
But, she does look a little bit like, what'd you say, Piers?
Piers Morgan,
Piers Morgan.
Also James May. I mean, she looks like a bevy of British...
Bevy of British faces.
Bastards, I don't know.
The BBFs.
Yeah.
What else do we want to talk about?
I think that's about it.
We've wrung all the Christmas joy out of this movie.
Mm-hmm. There's that moment in the live watch where Kevin hands over the card to the lady behind the counter, to Hester Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, a little incredulous, a little suspicious. And I said she should have bit the card to see if it was real.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out she kind of does. She scratches it. Like she's trying to see if it's fake, which I thought was a weird moment.
Yeah.
What is that going to tell you, lady?
I don't know. I mean, that's how fucked up credit cards used to be. You could just take a carbon copy impression of one.
And
that was good enough.
Just got the numbers.
And you know what? We really haven't progressed much beyond that. We still just essentially doing a digital knuckle buster.
Yeah.
Like, hey, oh, is this the number on the card? That's what the magnetic stripe says. Send it to the bank. Hey, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, what the fuck? I don't know. I could talk for hours about how needlessly insecure the credit card industry is. But
that's it. That's all the time we got.
Nobody wants to listen to that in a Christmas, nope. A Christmas film. We will be back, obviously. There's probably a lunch coming up at the end of this year week.
Yep.
One of our drunk Christmas lunches where we're going to pour some of the good stuff out, have an extra special Christmas edition of lunch, and we'll see you there or the next time, whenever that might be. Either way, I'm your Christmas host, Aaron.
And I'm your Christmas host, Jim.
Have a great Christmas.